This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Shall we begin?
Expecto Patronum!
BFM 89.9. It is 7:38. Hello, everybody. You are listening to Popcorn Culture. And through a series of unfortunate events today, we are all doing this show from home. And when I say all, I mean, of course, myself, Lee Chui Lin and Sharmila Ganesan. And we also have joining us, Dashun Johan.
Hello, yes. Everyone.
Yes, hello. Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dash.
No worries.
Unfortunately, I think Arvin had to be called away last minute. So thankfully, Dash agreed to step in. And we're doing a couple of things today. So we open the show with that little clip from A Fistful of Dollars because, of course, we wanted to mark the passing earlier this week of iconic composer Ennio Morricone.
Yes, I think just listening to that brought back so many memories of actually really growing up listening to so many of his compositions, not realizing who the genius behind all of it was. I was really sad when I heard about him passing. And I think mostly because of the fact that, like me, many people are sort of inadvertent fans of his for most of their lives, and only later upon adulthood sort of grow to realize just how much of his music you've been listening to.
Yeah, I think you brought up a great point there in terms of, you know, you especially growing up, maybe even more so because I when I was growing up, when I was young, you know, it was already Hans Zimmer and all these people were already coming in, you know. So but of course, because of my dad, because of, you know, the movies he used to watch on VHS, on TV and all. So I watched, you know, the Clint Eastwood movies of the 70s, all those Westerns, Sergio Leone's movie and all. And so I would always know this, the music, like the song we heard at the start of the show is, it's one of my favorite movie musical scores ever. But it was only until I was much older that I realized that it's by Ennio Morricone. Because when I was a kid, or, you know, when early stages, I don't think too much about who makes the music, who is pulling all these, you know, or doing all this orchestral stuff behind the scene. But the music really stuck with me. And I think that's what, you know, that's the genius of him, where he made a lot of iconic music and a lot of the music has a lot of layers to it, and it's very rich, and you know, it's no surprise that he has influenced so many people, including Hans Zimmer.
For sure. And I think it's also worth saying that he composed for over 400, you know,
yes,
films, yeah, and TV shows. It's a lot of scores. And so this idea of inadvertent, I think it goes back to a conversation that we've been having actually about classicness, about what is considered a classic, about at what point do we encounter these classics, at what point do we maybe even grow out of them. But the truth is that I think it's a beautiful thing that what you put out in the world, especially something that has as long a shelf life as cinema, will end up creeping its way into influences of people generations hence. And when they encounter, you know, when you encounter an Ennio Morricone score for the first time in the setting that it's meant to be encountered in, right? So not outside, not tributed, not just heard somewhere else. When you encounter it for the first time, in a cinematic setting, It's really memorable, I think. It's really something that stands apart. And that also speaks to the power of scores in general and the power of great scores.
And I think it really needs to be said because a lot of times his work gets reduced to the work that he did for Sergio Leone and for Westerns. And, you know, we started with the score from Fistful of Dollars, but, you know, he's done such beautiful work. His work for scoring The Thing, it's often held up for John Carpenter's The Thing. It's held up as an iconic sci-fi score. He did Cinema Paradiso, which is just, you know, beautiful, dramatic narrative music. He did The Untouchables, it's a gangster cinema. So really, he's someone who, while has become very associated with one genre, is someone who could really compose for anything at all.
And, you know, what you mentioned is very interesting because, you know, even me, myself, you know, I associate him mostly with the Western genre. But He got nominated six times. He won one, which was for Tarantino's movie, also a Western mysteries movie. But for the rest of his nominations, you know, it didn't come from the Sergio Leone movies and the stuff he did with the Western genre. It was, you know, romantic dramas, historical adventures. And so I find that very interesting how he got is considered to be the biggest film award for all the films that he's technically, or at least not known to the masses.
Mm.
So tell us your favorite Ennio Morricone score or moment. You know, we just wanted to mark his passing. It happened on the 6th of July, so earlier this week. And yeah, let us know. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can call 773-2900. And of course, tweet us at BFM Radio. And so now, not to make too fine a point of it, we're just going to go ahead to what the main theme of our show actually is today, because we wanted to talk about professions in cinema and how that's exemplified maybe by moments such as this.
Doc! Marty, you made it!
Yeah!
Welcome to my latest experiment. This is a big one, the one I've been waiting for all my life.
Well, it's a DeLorean, right?
Stay with me, Marty. All your questions will be answered. Roll tape.
Okay.
And we'll proceed.
Doc, is that a Devo?
Never mind that now. Not now. All right, I'm ready.
Good evening. I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing on the parking lot at Twin Pines Mall. It's Saturday morning, October 26, 1985.
1:18 a.m.
And this is temporal experiment number one.
What did I tell you? 88 miles per hour!
All right, so that was, of course, a little bit of, as he said himself, Dr. Emmett Brown, the quintessential scientist figure, right? Like, for the longest time, I expected all mad scientists to be mad, you know, or all scientists to be mad, to have the hair, to have the crazy coat, to have a DeLorean and a dog. And I think that it's a good example to start with in terms of how Hollywood maybe chooses to portray certain professions, certain jobs, and whether or not they do a good job of it, which is really what we're going to be talking about for the rest of the show.
So ironically, Doc Brown is kind of modeled on Albert Einstein, especially for his looks and some of his more outlandish gestures and all that. But I think on-screen scientists are generally one of a few things, right? They're either mad and jovial, or they are full of hubris and have evil plans to take over the world or to bring their creations forth. Nobody's just kind of a chill average scientist going about doing their research. And I think that's the key point. It doesn't make for good TV or filmmaking.
Yeah. You know, there's always this question, like you said, you know, a scientist, you know, what does a scientist really do? You know, he's probably writing on his notepad, writing on the whiteboard, typing. Yeah, I guess.
You mean not writing on glass, on clear
yeah,
glass?
Yes, you know, and then, you know, staring deeply at his computer screen for hours and hours, trying to figure stuff out. So that don't necessarily make for good cinema, right? But I think when it comes to jobs that are cinematic, right, there's there's probably two ways to look at it. Maybe, you know, there's always the, I think, jobs that make it, that are very easily made exciting on the big screen or the small screen, is jobs that have elements of heroism to it. So, you know, things like police, military, you know, crime solving, you know, because I think it's easy to just involve action sequences in with these jobs, or like put a villain there, or a villainous force that they need to take on, or, you know, even jobs that help people achieve some sort of greatness, you know, so maybe sports coaches, military generals, things like that. But, you know, going back to your point about, well, a scientist that's doing his day-to-day job be cinematic, I think I used to say no, but then, you know, after Social Network came out, my mind completely, you know, like, I think any job can be cinematic, right? Because at the end of the day, what we are going to, we want to watch stories about humans, and it's about how you tell those stories and make it as exciting and intriguing as possible.
You know, I think action sequences are one thing, and they're crucial, right? Because cinema is really about being able to see that motion, about being able to see things. But we've also spent this whole week talking about lawyers, essentially, because we started off with, I almost said As Good As It Gets. I don't know why my mind just went to Jack Nicholson, but we started off the week talking about A Few Good Men. We also reviewed Perry Mason. And so that job, I think, falls into that second category that you were talking about, Dash, where you're trying to help people achieve greatness or justice or some other high principles that, you know, you can, again, make very great. I think it's this idea of greatness that matters to cinema. And it's why also I think maybe some jobs that we ignore in real life also get ignored on cinema for those same reasons, because they're part of what makes our society run, but they're not necessarily involved with these higher principles of greatness. More's the pity.
No, and it's true. I think that we don't tell enough stories of those jobs, right? And therefore, those stories are not manifested in our books or on screen, and perhaps quite unfairly.
So let us know, is your job accurate when it's translated through the lens of Hollywood, whether it's in the form of movies or TV? You know, if you're a lawyer, if you're a scientist, if you're whatever job you do, if you've seen a version of it in cinemas and TV, is it accurate? Tell us how or how not. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can tweet us at BFM Radio, where we also have a poll up. And of course, you can call us as well at 7733-2900. We're going to be right back. Keep it on Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
I'm proud of you all. You make me proud. You reflect on me well, Gray. If you think you can keep your clothes on long enough to follow up the labs, I'd appreciate it. Karev, cover the pit.
Wait, the pit? I'm off gynae.
Dr. Montgomery Shepherd is out sick. You can cover the pit, or you can tell me whose damn panties are on the bulletin board. This is a hospital, people. Serious work happens here. We save lives here. Oh, something funny? Whose are these?
This is bad. This isn't good.
Hey, you better claim them. They're mine. Claim them.
No.
Yeah, no, it's one of you. BFM 89.9. It is 7:51, and you're listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn Sharmila and Dash, who is standing in for Arvin today. And together we are talking about two separate things. One, we want to know what your favorite memories are of Ennio Morricone and his iconic scores, because he passed on earlier this week. But we're also talking about professions, this idea of whether or not movies and TV accurately portray jobs and what the impact is of how they do it. And I think something like Grey's Anatomy, which we just heard, is a great example of that, because a hospital is a great setting for a TV show, if you think about it. There's lots of high drama, emotion, there's high stakes everywhere. But, you know, the way Grey's portrayed doctors, I think you could generously call questionable.
So I I found it quite interesting because I was doing a little bit of reading about the portrayal of doctors on screen. And there's actually been extensive research done on this because it's one of those professions that directly affects public perception and how people relate to doctors and seeking out treatment. And apparently it's only in fairly modern television and film, I think starting from the 60s onwards, where the quote-unquote respectable portrayal of doctors on screen changed to the more either salacious or more human view that we tend to get now. I think that's quite interesting because doctors are one of those jobs that, you know, I mean, coming from an Indian family, you're always told you should aspire to be, right? And I think it's still one of those jobs that in most places around the world, we hold to a certain regard. And I think perhaps for good reason, and sometimes breaking down that image isn't always to the best. I suppose it doesn't always do that profession a good service.
Yeah. I think, yeah, like you said, because I think what we see on screen a lot is doctors portrayed as these flawless, either that or, you know, they are these alcoholic people, but still they can come in at the last second and, you know, and save someone who just got a heart attack and things like that. But I agree with everything you say. And I was also reading an article where I think the Business Insider interviewed two final year medical students. And the students are saying that a lot of times, especially when we look at soap operas and all that, the doctors, what their real jobs are, I mean, not that saving lives aren't their real jobs, the extra layers to their jobs aren't really shown on screen. And so these medical students were jokingly, but also not jokingly, talking about how, you know, nobody ever makes a movie with doctors or a series with doctors where they are, you know, arguing with insurance companies for hours and hours. And they say that a lot of times, you know, that's part of the job. It's just we don't see that aspect of it.
I think the same is true of firefighters, right? Like when you think about firefighters, you don't necessarily see the movie where they do a lot of training and then maybe they get called to save a cat from a tree, you know, that sort of thing. In a movie, that is the early establishing shot, so you know your hero is a decent guy. But really what you want to see is that moment where they charge into a burning building. And I'm not saying that that's unfair or unimportant, just that it is true, right? Like, all of us, I think, who are working adults will accept that our jobs are at best a 70-30 split, you know, at best. And 30% of the time, it's really exciting and rewarding. And 70% of the time, it's the work so that you get to do the 30% that is exciting and rewarding. And I suppose it's okay to accept that Hollywood focuses on that exciting 30%. I think the issue is only when, like you said, soap operas, right? And I think that there is something about converting professions or converting careers into a soap opera setting that can sometimes maybe not do that profession the most justice.
For instance, there's a lot of research done into perceptions of things like organ donation, and how public trust in doctors in terms of how effective or how well things like organ donation will be handled actually drop after watching how they're handled on shows like Grey's. I think there was a particular episode where Dr. Yang, she basically decides to do something fairly unethical so that she could acquire an organ for a particular surgery she really wanted to do. I mean, things like this, they make for great storytelling, but they also genuinely feed into fears that people already have about certain professions and have real-world consequences.
But at the same time, so I'm always conflicted about this, right? Because on the one end, you know, it's you don't want to necessarily restrict filmmakers. Because if you look at it from outside the perspective of, let's say, doctors or whatever, you know, if you look at it, you know, Hollywood or cinema in general, you know, they glorify streetcar racers and all these things, right? So you don't want them to sort of put a false portrayal of doctors or any of these things, because you don't want it to affect people's perception of the reality. But at the same time, you know, where do you tell them, where do you draw the line between, you know, telling them not to, or to sort of have some sort of, not censorship, but, you know, not giving them the complete creative license to make whatever they want. So, you know, that's all. This is something that I'm always conflicted about. Which path should they go in?
Mm. I think it's also a question there of how important that job is to the storytelling. Mm. So in some cases, I think maybe I still have lawyers on the brain. And so I'm thinking about someone like Atticus Finch, who is, I think, held up as this emblematic figure and, you know, just so handsomely played as like this figure of justice. And that's fine, right? I mean, that's an important part of the story. That's a crucial, I think we've been talking in terms of hero and villain. And I think it's important sometimes to allow your hero to truly be heroic. And like you said, you don't want to offer those kinds of limitations. On the other hand, if you took something like Grace and you took it out of a hospital setting, does it really lose all that much? Right? I mean, honestly, like they could be in any other office.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's the whole point of shows like Grey, isn't it? That essentially you're retelling that same soap opera structure of tangled relationships and personal ambitions and emotions and family drama. You're just replaying it in different settings, you know. Police station for this show and a hospital for that show and so on and so forth. And I think that's part of the joy and familiarity of those genres as well.
I suppose that speaks, I think, to what we've been talking about, or what we are going to talk about, which is the importance of genre when we talk about professions, because it plays into it a lot. When people say cop show, you know instantly what you mean. When you say courtroom drama, you know what you mean. And I think the same is true of movies as well, where you kind of have an expectation going in to, for example, military movies. And I was thinking earlier, by the way, that Dash, when you were giving examples of military generals and football coaches, were you thinking of Gene Hackman? Because he's literally done those things.
Yes. That is literally the person that I was thinking of.
All right. So we are talking today about how Hollywood does in terms of depicting jobs and professions. We want to know specifically, how do you think they've done by your job, a job that you know intimately well? You can let us know by WhatsApping 018-789-8899, call us at 7733-2900, and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Building fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race, and the human race is filled with passion. Medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for. To quote from Whitman, O me, O life, of the questions of these recurring, of the endless trains of the faithless, of cities filled with the foolish, what good amid these, O me, O life? Answer, that you are here, that life exists and identity, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse, that the powerful play goes on and you may contribute a verse. What will your verse be?
It is 8:07 and you are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn Sharmila and Dash. And today we're talking about jobs and how jobs are depicted on screen. And so I think we've actually been kind of down on the whole concept for a bit, mostly because we've been talking about doctors and lawyers, two professions that I think when depicted on, when shown on screen, tend to have a slightly shadier vibe, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But Teachers, on the other hand, are almost always shown in a fantastic light or in an inspirational, life-changing way. And I think that what we just heard, Dead Poets Society, is a great example of that.
Yeah, and you know, I also think that it's one of those professions. It's one of those professions that really, for many people, shaped their idea of what it means to be a teacher. And to be fair, lawyers have that too sometimes with characters like Atticus Finch, who you mentioned earlier, Denzel Washington in movies like in you know, Philadelphia, for instance, where many people actually credit these performances and these characters as being directly the reason why they wanted to be teachers or wanted to be lawyers. And certainly Dead Poets Society is iconic as that teacher character that inspired generations of people who want to study poetry and love poetry. And but I also think it's one of those things that really does resonate with people, because every time we do Teachers Day shows, we get these beautiful messages from people texting in, talking about their teachers who inspired them to go down a certain path, who inspired them to realize their full potential. So I think part of it is that there is some element of truth at the heart of these portrayals as well.
And I agree with you about that, some element of truth there, because I think on our day-to-day sort of life, we don't think of teachers that much, unless we are still a student, you know, and that's just part of the setting. But other than that, we don't really think too much of teachers. In fact, we are learning from teachers to be something else, to be something, you know, quote-unquote, greater and all that. And I think in life, maybe teachers, in real life, teachers don't get enough credit. And what I love about how they portray teachers in cinema is they don't necessarily portray them as, you know, these high earning, you know, people, and they're driving fancy cars and all that. So, but that's not the idea of what it takes to be a great teacher. It is, you know, as we heard from the Dead Poets Society clip earlier, it's about, you know, teachers, about these individuals helping a group tap into their potential and their, you know, their passion, and help them find their passion and achieve greatness. And I think, because we don't look at teachers that way on a day-to-day basis, when Hollywood or whatever, you know, in the film industry around the world shows us that, it really gets us thinking, and it really, I think that's where, you know, you sometimes want to be, become inspired to be a teacher as well.
Yeah, so that's what I wanted to ask you guys, whether or not there was ever a depiction of something in a movie that made you want to be that thing, because teachers definitely did it for me. For one, I think when I was younger, I was power tripping off the idea of being able to say yes or no, right or wrong with a red pen. For some reason, it's just a tremendous symbol of power. But also when I was young, I watched To Sir With Love, which of course had the great Sidney Poitier doing you know, portraying a fantastic teacher, Mark Thackeray. And I think we've seen this come up time and time again, right? You've seen it in, we've talked about Dead Poets Society, there's Michelle Pfeiffer in Dangerous Minds. Yeah. So we know that there is this trope, but my first introduction to a great teacher can change lives that are maybe headed down a not so great path was actually To Sir With Love.
You know, it's no coincidence that I mentioned Atticus Finch or Philadelphia. It's no coincidence that I watched Perry Mason. I grew up wanting to be a lawyer, and I very much credit TV and film. A lot of Indian films had these, like, you know, justice-driven lawyers who got, you know, the underdog out of whatever trouble they were in.
Never about money. It's no, never about money.
And to be fair, I mean, that was really what finally drove me into journalism, because I realized that lawyering had a lot of work, you know, again, the 30%, 70%, and I didn't think that 70% was something I was necessarily interested in, but at least that interest in social justice, in that interest in wanting to be someone's voice was what I think led me to being a journalist. What about you, Lynn? What about you, Dash?
For me, lawyer is definitely one of those professions that, you know, it's really inspiring, because like you said, it's about fighting for the little guy. And sometimes it's not, even when you're fighting for the criminal, you know, you are sort of mesmerized by the ability to debate and to tell a story and to convince people. But you also mentioned journalism, and that's where I'm going to go with this. I know Newsroom is kind of a polarizing series, but I'm a huge fan of the series, and I'm a huge fan of Aaron Sorkin in general. To me, he can't do anything wrong. But yeah, I was so intoxicated, not necessarily by, you know, the constant yelling that happens in Newsroom, but by, you know, this room of very smart individuals who are hungry for the truth, who are hungry to tell a story. And when they go into the office, they are surrounded by like-minded people, and they always seem to, you know, be bursting with passion for the, and you know, they have the drive and you know, all these small, I get so mesmerized by how, you know, there's always this, okay, they're going to go on air in 10 minutes, but then there's this big story and now everyone is panicking and they are trying to find for, you know, someone to comment and all. And, you know, I'm a new to BFM. So, you know, it's not like a crazy as Newsroom, but, you know, occasionally when you know, we do get these things where we are supposed to hunt for guests and all, it does, you know, bring back memories of Newsroom, and it gives me a thrill.
I'm glad to hear that, Dash. I don't know if we all feel that, but I'm glad. It's nice to hear.
Maybe because I'm still new.
No, don't say that. So we've been getting some messages. Let's talk about Ennio Morricone first. So we have Pat Justice on Twitter saying, The Mission, Gabriel's Oboe. We also have Tenny, who's saying, was introduced to Ennio Morricone in 1992, 1992's City of Joy, which of course starred Patrick Swayze. Tenny also said, Grey's Anatomy was a fantastic series. New shows today, The Residents. My doctors at the hospital say that in an ER, it is nothing like how we watched on TV. I do think that it's important to clarify that while we kind of bagged quite a bit on Grey's, in my day, I've seen a fair amount of it because it has that addictive soap opera quality. Mm. But it is because of that I asked the question, does it matter whether it's set in Seattle Grace or not, you know, it doesn't really matter. On the other hand, we also have people weighing in on whether or not their professions are accurate. So we have this on Twitter. Design engineers do use touch screens and 3D models, but most of the work is just research and calculations. So yes, we use 3D models, but no, we do not use holograms ever.
Now I'm very disappointed because I kind of want to imagine someone's using holograms for their work every day.
I want someone who works at, you know, in a crime scene investigation to tell me if you can really zoom in on a security camera onto a license plate. Zoom in. Zoom in on that. No, and zoom in always, on that.
And they always have some button, or they just move the mouse a bit, or like the tech guy will just like
exactly
randomly
need to see.
Yeah, and it's like it just suddenly becomes so clear. I'm like, what cameras are you guys using?
Cinematic pleasure, that's what it is. We don't need reality. We also have Jolie Anna saying, Suits, when Mike Ross humpil lemas di humpap documents, so almost drowns, getting crushed by documents. I think that's a fair translation. And long hours alone in the office doing research, preparing pleadings. Yep, that's us lawyers.
That's the 70% I didn't want. Yeah. There you go.
Mm-hmm. There we go. And we also have Munif Malik saying, as an architect, the movie Click got it spot on. We're so busy and preoccupied with literally building happiness for others that we miss out on what's important in our own life. Gotta stop working the weekends, man.
Oh, no. I mean, I wouldn't have thought Click was a movie that was going to come up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that brings up the interesting point of also this idea of certain professions being depicted as not necessarily for the profession itself, but what it does to your personal life. And Click and architecture, or you want to talk about, say, something like Wall Street and or other movies that deal with finance and what that does to somebody's personal life.
Devil Wears Prada.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There you go. And I think that's sort of the mirror image of not just the profession, but personal life of that profession.
And I think that goes back to that my earlier point about I brought up Social Network, right? Because that's what's so interesting to me. Yes, of course, I also love movies where it's just about the profession, and you know, even if it glorifies it and all, if it's entertaining, sure. But I always love how, you know, on one end, you have this person achieving greatness, but at the same time, they are not flawless. You know, he could be achieving greatness at work, but then he could, you know, not probably, you know, he or she is not a good parent to their child. You know, things like that, I feel like how all these affects your friendships, your relationships with your wife, with your kids and all that. I think that's very interesting.
On a more superficial level, I would also like to point out that romantic comedies often, to that point about personal life, sometimes jobs are used simply to give a character a lifestyle. So, you know, I think that this has been, what was that Rebel Wilson movie that kind of made fun of romantic comedies that came out on Netflix?
Yes, that's right. I know exactly which one you're talking about.
But yes, the one with Priyanka Chopra as well.
That's right. So I think that movie depicted her as an architect, not for the long hours that Adam Sandler in Click, Isn't It Romantic? Thank you. So our producer kind of saved the day. So yes, Isn't It Romantic? That movie, she was an architect. I don't think at all necessarily to talk about the job or to comment on it, but simply because architects, jobs like architects, bakers, magazine editorial assistants, they tend to be shorthand in romantic comedies for works in the city, dresses really nice, can afford to go out for drinks. And it's just to buy the character a certain lifestyle. And so I think sometimes jobs on a more superficial level also fulfill that function in movies.
Oh yeah, versus artist or bookstore owner who is shorthand for quirky and, you know, likes cute things and is whimsical and will wear prints.
Usually Meg very Ryan. Carefree.
Yes.
The little shop around the corner.
That's right.
So we are talking today about how jobs are shown on movies and TV, and also asking the question of whether or not they're accurate. So firstly, have you ever watched anything on screen that made you want to be that job? And if so, tell us what it is. But also, now that you presumably currently occupy a job, how do you feel when you see it depicted on screen? Is it accurate or not? You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio as well, where we have a poll running. And so far, asking the same question, whether your job is accurately depicted, 70.9% are saying not at all. So I think that's pretty true to form. We're going to come back right after this to continue this conversation. Keep it here on Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Break from monotony, BFM 89.9.
People come up to me all the time and say, you should be a model, or you look just like a model, or maybe you should try to be a man who models. And I always have to laugh because I'm so good looking. Of course I'm a model. I guess my best known look is Ferrari. That would be the look that I really made my bread and butter on.
Could you do that for us?
Sure. I guess I'm also known for Blue Steel.
Can we see that one?
Blue Steel?
Yeah.
Ferrari is a much more aggressive look. Blue Steel I really save for softer catalog work. Shoes. I am always working on new looks. If I have a day off, I will spend 4 to 8 hours in front of the mirror trying a tilt of a head or a furrow. I mean, a lot of people think the eyes are what it's all about. I find it's the forehead.
BFM 89.9. It is 8:23. You are listening to Popcorn Culture with Lynn, Sharmila and Dash. Today, we're talking about how jobs are portrayed on screen. And you just heard there, supermodel Derek Zoolander, or also somebody who is soon to build a school for ants. Never forget.
And every time I listen to it, I feel kind of bad for laughing. But I also think that there are just some jobs that are perpetually the butt of jokes, whether it's the vapid model or the boring accountant. And I often wonder how, I know I have friends who are accountants, and I often wonder how they feel, because people do hold those stereotypes fairly strongly against them.
The weird dentist.
The weird dentist,
oh,
yeah.
Yes.
So it must be, I don't know. I mean, because I do a job that's often perceived as fairly cool by most media portrayals. I don't know how I'd be able to deal with the fact if everyone thought, oh, just because I worked in numbers that I must be really boring and spoke in monosyllables.
Very nice for the media to portray the media as something very cool.
Well, yeah.
Works out for us in the end. Yeah. But I think where I wanted to go with this was, do we think that some jobs, maybe it's time to have a more updated showing? Because I do think that, maybe models is not the hill I'm trying to die on here. But I do think that there are some professions that for a long time have been depicted a certain way. And I'm thinking particularly of a show like Brooklyn Nine-Nine, for example, that even right now, they are asking these questions about whether or not they want to continue amidst these stories of Black Lives Matter and police brutality, because they don't feel good, I think, depicting police as lovable goofs, just, you know, your friendly neighborhood Brooklyn Nine-Nine cops, when maybe that's not the reality that people are facing. So I do wonder whether there are some jobs that perhaps require an update of sorts.
Go ahead, Dash.
Okay, sorry. I think the point you brought up about, the example you gave about cops is probably like thing that stands out to me the most, because I think in a lot of shows, right, and to me it's not just about the cops, it's also about how they always portray internal affairs as these villains that are trying to ruin the relationships of the cops. And if a younger cop is trying to, you know, like report to the internal affairs, then they are, you know, seen as, you know, a snitch and all that. And that's how Hollywood has portrayed cops for the longest time. You see them beat up suspects, and as an audience, you are cheering them on. You see them plant evidence, and again, you're cheering them on, because, you know, anything to get the bad guy, you know, whatever the cop says is the bad guy, that's the bad guy. But when in reality, that's technically, you know, it goes against the law. And in reality, the actual good guys are the internal affairs guys, because they are sort of the HR people who are, you know, in doing all these investigations to make sure that everything is going, going according to, following the proper code of conduct. But yet in movies and in series, time and time again, you are always portraying the internal affairs guys as the bad guys. And I think probably that is something we need to reframe, especially given our current climate.
I'm also thinking of I always take a lot of offense at the way female journalists are portrayed in films or in TV shows. Someone like Zoe Barnes from House of Cards, for instance.
She is so unethical.
But the thing is, it's such a tired trope that, and I think this has to do with a holdover from when the gender balance on a lot of professions were not viewed very favorably. But there's still this assumption that when women are in the media, women are journalists, that they, for instance, sleep with sources, or that they flirt with people who are more powerful to get stories, that they use their sexuality or their looks, or somehow they're more conniving than their more upstanding, truth-driven male counterparts. And so I think that's one trope that could definitely use an update. I mean, there have been much better portrayals off late, but I still think that's something that persists in hanging around.
That's a great point, and it's something that I want to build on, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, about maybe celebrating the more mundane, maybe celebrating the 70% instead of just the 30% of greatness that we experience. Yeah. But before that, we do have some messages. So on Twitter, we have Myfiholic saying, patient intubated but miraculously can speak, urine tube used as oxygen tube, plenty of facepalm medical scenes in local drama productions. I can't even begin.
Yes, I've heard of these being shared as memes. I mean, I've seen these shared as memes online.
Frankly, I think if we were to start picking apart factual inaccuracies in films, we'd just be here till like midnight. Mm-hmm. We also have Munif Malik back to say, hands down, clowns get the shortest end of the cinematic stick as far as occupation representation goes.
Well, I mean, if you're talking about the Joker.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they are not the accurate representations, but they are pretty great representations. You got Joker, you got It. Yeah.
But it goes back to that idea of associating a certain trait mm-hmm. with a certain profession, that you must somehow be psychologically disturbed if you decide yeah. to become a clown or a comedian. Or it's always that trope, right? Someone who does something funny for a living must in fact be broken inside.
Is Modern yeah. Family's Cameron Tucker the most nuanced portrayal of a clown? He may
the
be.
The most normal portrayal of a clown, yeah. clown possibly.
Which is a yeah. sad thing, if you really think about it. You yeah, have Pennywise and Cameron.
Yeah, he's fun off for wanting to be a clown.
So, and we also have this from Walter, who says, pilots are often depicted as glamorous and womanizers until the movie Sully.
Oh, absolutely. I have a friend who married a pilot, and she had relatives who would bring this up with her. Like, are you sure? Are you sure you want to get married to a pilot? So I think you're definitely a stereotype.
Yeah.
And I think that brings us to the point I wanted to end the show on, which is, how do we feel about movies that maybe show jobs as not all that exciting, but just a part of... a part of the story or a part of the character? Because I think not all the time, I know that we're not always in the mood, but I'm ready for it. I was thinking here of Jim Jarmusch and Patterson, which starred Adam Driver as a poetry writing bus driver. Just really in love with his wife. And like, that's the whole story. I'm not giving anything away, but that is also more or less the summation of the story. And it's a lovely, slow, beautiful little film. And he is just that. And it's important that he is that, but it's no more, no less.
I think it's also the 70% that you mentioned, a movie like Spotlight, for instance. The reason why both Hollywood and actual journalists hold it up so high is because it not only shows you the heights that journalism can achieve, it shows you the true mundaneness of knocking on door after door after door, of going through ledger after ledger after ledger to get the information that then gets you there. And I think that's quite important.
Yeah, because I think there is something beautiful in the so-called mundane. I think Patterson is one very good example, because it's a beautiful film. It really reaches you emotionally, but it doesn't have grand moments of drama or these huge conflicts and all that. But on the other side, I think you can also show mundaneness or the day-to-day aspects or the reality of certain jobs without it going even in the Patterson route, right? Because if you are looking at, like you brought up Spotlight, it is about the constant struggle and struggle and struggle and struggle to no ends, right? And even if you look at like David Fincher's Zodiac, you know, it's just journalists and people getting so obsessed and just trying to figure it out day in, day out. They're drowning themselves in alcohol and cigarettes to nothing. At the end, they don't find the killer. The crime, the Zodiac crime, is still not solved. So I think there is excitement. It doesn't always have to have this sort of hero's journey.
Yeah, and I wanted also to recommend in that same vein, Can You Ever Forgive Me?, which is a beautiful movie. And again, it stars a writer, a playwright, you know, and depending on how you want to view it, or, you know, just straight up a scammer. And these are professions that are usually... Is a scam artist a profession? Anyway, these are occupations then that are usually shown a certain way. People are kind of glamorous. They go for parties. They sit around at dinner parties and trade witticisms. And none of that happens in this film. And yet, like you said, Dash, it has its highs and lows. It has its moment of real peril and real grandeur. But it also doesn't kind of resort, I guess, to the tired old tropes of careers and jobs that we're used to. So yeah, I think that there's room for a lot more.
And like, every life is a story worth telling in some way.
Oh, that's lovely. Okay, that's, all right. I think we should conclude on that. But if you'd like to keep those thoughts coming on whether or not your job is accurate in terms of how Hollywood chooses to portray it, or for that matter, whether there was ever anything that you watched on TV or on film that made you want to be that job, do that job, you can let us know. That number is 018. Oh, gosh, I've forgotten the number.
018-789-8899.
You know, I could see it in my brain and not say it. This is the peril of doing a show at 8:30. But yes, you can keep letting us know. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. If you would like to know more of what we have coming up, you can find us at BFM Popcorn on both Twitter and Instagram. You've been listening today to Popcorn Culture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.